the following program may contain content that your kids would love to hear, but you may not want them to.
It's time once again to be flabbergasted by the rolling tongue, the juggling of words, thoughts, and phrases, like a Spaniard on a tightrope. Here is the one, the only, the man of 2 hours, Frank Cottolo.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Cottolo.
Okay, here we go.
Listening to Frank Cottolo.
Kevorkian. A lot of you know me simply as Dr. Death. As you know, I recently agreed to stop assisting patient suicides. But now my years of experience can be yours in my new book, Dr. Kevorkian's Book of Home Remedies. You know, doctors have long known how to cure common ailments with simple items found around the house. Foot pain got you down, son? Then just soak that foot in a bathtub full of hot salt water with a cup of vinegar and a tablespoon of castor oil. Then just add a string of Christmas lights. Sure, it's messy. But you won't hear him complaining.
Doctor, I'm so depressed. I've got a splinter in my finger.
Well, then, try to find a good vein. Then, just use a ordinary hypodermic needle with common household air. Inject a small bubble of air directly into the artery.
Are you sure about this?
Positive. Works every time. Dr. Kevorkian's Book of Home Remedies is full of thousands of these handy cures for such ailments as burns, scrapes, scabies, even headaches. Just listen to one of my recent patients.
I suffer from terrible migraines. Regular doctors couldn't do anything for me. But then Dr. Kevorkian's book suggested many household items to alleviate my pain. First of all...
I found this 12-gauge just lying around the bedroom closet. That's probably the first good rest she's had in days. And you'll rest in peace, too, when you order Dr. Kevorkian's Book of Home Remedies.
To order, call 1-600-DR-DEATH. Please have your credit card ready. We will not bill you later.
What became of your lamb, Clary?
I killed.
You still wake up sometimes, don't you? Wake up in the dark and hear the screaming of the lamb.
Yes.
Do you think if you save poor Catherine, you could make them stop, don't you? You think if Catherine lives, you won't wake up in the dark ever again to that awful screaming of the lamb?
I don't know. I don't know.
Thank you, Clary.
Thank you.
wake up. It's night, everyone. The Bard of Broadcasting, now on the air on this Y2K Plus 14 Cthulhu Chronicle. Yes, neo-postmodernists, you sunburnt sicklemen of October aweary, here we go. It's not going to be that heavy. It's going to be important, because everything we do is important, even when you laugh. My name is Frank Atoma, the man whose name adorns the title of the show. Dr. Karen Wyatt is with us, and you're going to be here with us as we continue. Like a Spaniard in a palm tree, whatever. From Ice Cap to Ice Cap, from Hamlet to City, from Othello and into every bordello, tis I, amongst the whilst and a whilst the amongst, certainly among the living, thank goodness, and that is my choice, I may add, to be here, and we're going to get Dr. Karen Wyatt soon on the show. I want to say this, though, that during our collage there, we're going to be talking about a very sensitive issue, death with dignity, a lot about death going on here. But the idea of playing Jim Carrey from that old television show in Living Color, making fun of Dr. Kevorkian. And by the way, if I put in a plug here, Dr. Kevorkian appears in the Molotov memoirs. A book which will be coming out shortly and probably a good Christmas gift. See, that was really low to do that. But here's the deal. The deal is that, sometimes joking and, let's say, making fun of death itself and as someone who's defied it a number of times, not always my own power to have cheated it, but certainly luck counts, but, you know, it makes a little laugh here and there, lighten it up a little bit because it helps. It helps because it relieves the stress of dealing with it. And I don't want you all to be running now and saying like, oh no, we can't, no, this is going to be too heavy. It's not going to be heavy. And there is something in the news that I thought would be perfect for us having Dr. Karen Wyatt on again. She has spent more time with people dying than anyone I know, and I know some people, and I have spent any number of hours myself. She's a professional psychiatrist, and that's why I call her doctor. It's not like doctor, any doctor. What's this? What is this? Who's calling on me here? Doctor. Already something's happening on my Skype. What is that? Oh, I'm here. Interesting. You never know what all these contraptions we have here today. Oh, my name is Frank Atoma. My man's name is the title of the show. We're going to do this, and we're going to talk to Dr. Karen Wyatt for the rest of the show concerning something that's in the news, and which will always be in the news. The dignity of the death of dignity. It's called the death of dignity. Ah, boy. It's amazing, isn't it? Because so many things go through my head. I thought of like 20,000, if 10, ways of doing this show from the top, you know, before I get the guest. And instead, what did I do? I danced around it, you know. It's a very touchy subject for a lot of us. You see what I'm saying? But Dr. Wyatt takes it very seriously. She's written a great book called What Really Matters, which you can get at Amazon. And we'll do more promoting of her various items that she has for sale. And then how you can get in touch with her. Actually, you can do a Skype. I didn't know this until recently. A lot of people are doing this now. You can do a Skype session with her. So you don't have to travel to Mountain Time. Unless, of course, you live in Mountain Time, in which case you don't have to travel to Mountain Time. What is happening? Okay, I want to tell you about next week, and then we'll leave the subject for the doctor and I when the doctor, who is available when we get the doctor on the Skype phone. But I want to mention that next week, which would be the 30th, while everyone is doing their little dumb little, I shouldn't say that, their dumb little Halloween shows, there's a Halloween thing that goes on and will continue to go on so that you can sell cards and costumes and stuff. Right? That's really what it's all about, isn't it? Isn't Halloween, I don't know the history of Halloween. I'm not going to do a show about this. I'm not going to do a theme show or anything. But isn't that another one of those things? I know it's the night, the Day of the Dead. Is it the Day of the Dead? Dia de Muerte. It has something to do with the Mexican tradition. Because I remember in Los Angeles going to a Day of the Death party. Day of the Death party. Why, I know, why don't you just make, I can't make it lower. Don't you people understand? I can't go to, I went to a Day of the Death party because a lot of friends I had when I lived in Los Angeles were Spanish. And then the night before Halloween in the Catholic religion is All Souls Night? Right, All Souls Night. And then the next day is All Saints Day. All Souls Night, All Saints Day. So there's this whole thing going on in the culture about those who die on Thursday and then Halloween. And I don't even know what Halloween means. You look it up. You do the work. I'm not going to go into this. But while that is going on, whenever it is going on in your neighborhood, we'll be here with another doctor. But this is a different doctor. This is a doctor of time, space, math, and science, Dr. Andrew Woldar from that fantastic university that he works, where he teaches. And he comes here exclusively at Cotolo Chronicles and talks about any number of things, like pick a number from 1 to 100, and he'll talk about it. And he's going to be here, and my former partner, Tom Savino, will be joining in on the fun. It'll be good, but it's another talk about scientific things and things going on. What is it about? I'll tell you exactly what it's about, so you'll find out. It has to do with... what does it have to do with here? Right? One of those time travel, a rabbit hole, rabbit holes, time travel, and Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice in Wonderland. How does that all fit together? You'll find out. He was a mathematician. Dr. Woldar, Tom Savino, and me, of course, will be here. It's a metaphysical romp. It's a metaphysical romp. Okay, and you don't get metaphysical romps anywhere on talk radio, certainly not on AM. And on FM, they're not talking. When they do talk, they talk like they do on the pretentious broadcasting system. Slow and like that. And it's for all idiots. And they don't do that here. We don't do that here. This is Cotolo Chronicles. My name is Frank Cotolo. Man, his name is on the title. So be here. That'll end October for us as we move into November of Y2K plus 14. So we head toward the 15th. I was thinking about, well, I don't want to think about that. I don't like thinking about time. But I'll tell you one thing. It is time right now to tell you. More Molotov Memoirs is coming out. You could still get the first edition at blurb.com. And you can get it for your iPhone, your Kindle, your Nook, your Nookle, your Kindlook, anything else that you... I don't even know how many of those things are... I talked to someone last week. I said, oh, you don't have a Kindle, so you can't get the book. Even licensed to Skill, of course, which is on Amazon for Kindle. It's on the Kindle list. And they said, oh, you can't get it because you don't have a Kindle. And he said, well, that's nonsense. You know, anyway, it's amazing how people know what to do. That's what I mean about this internet. They know what to do. And this generation that has grown up with all of this digital technology around them certainly has the proficiency and know-how to do whatever they want. So if you get yourself a book that can go, they say that's only Kindle format, and you know, they figure it out. License to Skill is available on Amazon, just like Dr. Karen Wyatt's What Really Matters. And what really matters is that you get both of these books. They couldn't be more different than day from night. And sometimes I think day and night are pretty much the same. But you can get those books. They're, wait a second. I don't know. I'll have to ask Dr. Wyatt if her book is available. It's got to be. Everything's available now in digital and in print. That's not true, because License to Skill is not available in print. Did you know that, did you? But you go get Molotov Memoirs, the original, and I'm going to give you more news as the time gets nearer. Once again, the fabulous artwork and design of T. Stephen Gesick, who, of course, is a fabulous art director on the MTV show Awkward, teams with me, Frank Tolo, to come up with this wonderful book about the not only stories that I think happened to me. These aren't things that happened, they're things that I think happened. And there are plenty of things, because I've been around a while, and I've led it. And this is what is meant when someone says, but he's led a storied life. And that's the way they say it. That's the way they say it. Suddenly I channel someone from Ireland. Usually it's that same old dumb Brooklyn voice. You know, that thing. But in any event, in all events, and certainly in this event, that will be happening. Join Dr. Andrew Woldar, Tom Savino. We're going to go into the rabbit hole. Alice in Wonderland, the whole deal. Lewis Carroll, who, of course, why was I talking about Lewis Carroll to someone else, too, recently? Well, these things come together. Isn't it amazing? What else? I don't know what's happening in November. At least not on this show. I mean, there's a number of things happening in November, but I don't know what we will get. We have promised you any number of other guests, and we're still working on that. Also, maybe in November or the end of December, Tom Savino, who will be on the show with me, with Dr. Andrew Woldar. Dr. Andrew Woldar personally requested, because last time, I guess he knew that Tom understood that more than I did when he was talking. Maybe, I don't know, it's just me being self-effacing again. But Tom Savino's Savino Veritas, coming soon to SRN MediaWorks. And remind everyone out there who's listening to the show on the great number of radio stations that carry it, internet and landmine. You know, that's what they're going to do. That's what they're going to be, the radio stations. Brick-and-mortar radio stations can be landmines. Any radio station or any broadcast vehicle. How about that? Any broadcast vehicle that you could will be able to use Savino Veritas on a replay. It'll be live and exclusive at SRN MediaWorks. Just like us. Us? I act like there's an entire staff here. And there's not. There's just me, and we're going to shortly get in touch with Dr. Karen Wyatt and talk about this. Should I do some pre-work on this? Pre-work? What's pre-work? Should I? You know, I keep forgetting the last name of the, and I should really find out, shouldn't I? I should go to my internet here. Look at that. It doesn't, how come sometimes this, oh yeah. You know, when you clear your history, you've got to hear. Okay, CatoloChronicles.blogspot.com. This is where, by the way, you can find all the other stations that run the show on its replay during the week. And, of course, 148.ca/Frank. And that's my blog page. You want to read my blogs before you go to the blogs of people who have important opinions and stuff. And you don't have to read everybody else's opinion. It's not your own blog. It's your own opinion. But you go and you read 148.ca/Frank. And, you know, we're talking about entertainment, not entertainment because it's my opinion and what I think about things. But this is a thing. This is a current affair. And I know they put this in a time capsule, this particular show in a time capsule with other shows. It will definitely mark a certain time in the history of the United States, because we're going to talk about Brittany Maynard, the 29-year-old brain cancer diagnosed girl. It's something I can't even call a 29-year-old, but she's a woman. Who has decided to end her own life as opposed to wilting away or doing whatever happens with brain cancer. It's not good. I know. I have known I've known many people who've died of cancer. I don't know anyone who's ended their own life as opposed to letting the disease run its course. But I do know one, I'm trying to think if it's more than one. Yes, one person who died of brain cancer. I really don't know anymore. Of course, both my parents died of cancer. Dr. Wyatt's mother, I believe, died of cancer. But I'm trying to say, like, what brain? What do we have? Brain arm cancer, lung cancer, brain cancer? Who knows? What the difference is in terms of how you pass on? Because I think that's probably just a personal thing. Personal thing. Well, I mean, is, you know, what happens to you doesn't happen to someone else, and two people have this kind of cancer, and one goes fast, one doesn't go fast, and how they do it. But Brittany Maynard has made the news by making this decision and moving to a state where there is a law called the Death with Dignity Law. And this is not going to be a political or a moral oriented show, but we are going to be dealing with and talking about people who are for or against these kind of things. And amazing, there's more states now that allow gay marriage than allow death with dignity. Maybe that's because it hasn't come up on the ballot. We'll find out more about that. I did all the stuff. You know where to go and what to read. Netzerati, Couple Surfers, Netaholics, Infomaniacs. Hello. Let's get Dr. Wyatt on the line and just talk through this, because this is a lot of disturbing things about whatever comes up is going to come up. Oh, there you go. That came up there. A little early, but I'm sure.
Hello.
Hello.
Is that
the doctor in the house?
This is the doctor.
The doctor's in the house. Oh, good evening, Dr. Wyatt.
Hi, Frank. Good to hear your voice.
Hey, thank you. That's one of them out there. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, very well.
So you're in good health?
Yes.
That's fine.
Just recently got back from a trip to France, which was wonderful.
You were in France. Whoa. I was recently talking to someone about my days in France way back when. How is France these days?
It was lovely. We spent our time, part of the time in Paris, but then we did a walking tour of Corsica, and then we went to the south of France, near Nice for the very end of the trip. So.
Wow, I have a good friend who lives there. He's American, but he is an expatriate.
Oh.
And he's lived his life, not his whole life, but I mean, in the last, I don't know how many years now, he's lived over there as a teacher. And he's always riding his bike. He's always telling me about all the great places, you know, when you get out of Paris, you just ride your bike and go out there in the countryside. Did you see a lot of that countryside then?
No, we didn't see the countryside in France itself. We did this hiking tour through Corsica, so we were on a lot of trails there on the island of Corsica. But we kind of stuck to the cities more for the rest of our trip. So now we have to go back so we can see the countryside.
Did you saunter down the Champs-Élysées and stop for espresso just about everywhere, or what?
Yes, we did. We did just about everything a tourist would do, Eiffel Tower and all the tourist attractions, but we had a wonderful time.
Is it still packed walking at any given time down the Champs-Élysées?
It wasn't, but then we were there near the end of September, and so the day we were walking, it was, you know, there were people, there were definitely a lot of people, but it didn't feel that crowded.
What was the best? Had you been to France before?
No, oh. First trip ever.
What was the highlight for you? What if you never went back? What's the one thing you'd really remember about that trip?
Well, one evening we came across a little church, which was one of the oldest churches apparently in the city of France. And there was a sign up that said there was a concert going on that night, a Chopin concert. So we decided, hey, let's just go to it. It was starting in 10 minutes. We bought tickets at the door. And inside, it was this very small church. There were only about 30 people there. We got to sit in the second row, and we heard a concert pianist play the most amazing Chopin concert that I've ever heard. And the acoustics were phenomenal. And it was like a dream. A dream. It was just so amazing to be experiencing that.
That's a very telling experience to make that your memorable experience. I'm always fascinated at places that are ancient. I've been in a number of ancient places, and what you mentioned when you said they have the acoustics were terrific, because they seem to have known that they had to present to an audience. I mean, they didn't know microphones. They didn't have any of that stuff. I mean, look at the Globe Theater, right?
Yeah.
It's amazing how they knew to build these places for speaking without the tools that we have today. But when you were a kid, did you pronounce it Chopin?
I don't think I knew about Chopin when I was a kid. Okay. I probably would have though, because I grew up in Wyoming.
I threw up in Wyoming once too. No, you grew up in Wyoming, right? That's right. You grew up in the same Pete Williams. You grew up in the same town as Pete Williams. Is that correct?
Yes, I went to high school with Pete Williams. I knew him.
Wow.
He was in drama, and we were in a play together in, let's see, which one was it? I think it was The Music Man.
I'm just amazed I remembered that when you said Wyoming and Pete Williams. And now everybody's Googling, my younger audience going, Pete Williams, who's that? Pete Williams. Googling Pete Williams. Okay, well, we're going to, there's no way I can dance around this anymore, this particular issue. When I heard about this, on CBS, I immediately thought of you and said, well, you know what? Let's see if Dr. Y is going to be available to talk about this, because I don't know anyone who has spent more time, no, it's professional time. I certainly don't know anyone who's gotten paid for being with people who are dying, but now I do. But you have spent so much time with people whose lives were noticeably ending. Right? In hospice or wherever else, and people with cancer and stuff. And Brittany Maynard, when you heard about this, obviously, how would you not hear about this? I'm not telling you anything. Mm-hmm. What was your first reaction about her doing, a younger woman deciding this? And then we'll go into the other aspects of death with dignity.
So my first reaction actually was, I'm a mom and my two kids are close to the same age as Brittany. And so my first reaction was just utter pain and heartbreak at the thought of a young person having to go through this experience and, relating to it as a mom, like, oh my gosh, knowing just how young 29 is and how little life has been lived yet at that point.
Now, are you saying, because I had the same reaction, but I mean, it had nothing to do with her decision to end it. You're talking about the fact that she's diagnosed with brain cancer and they said, that's it. That's what you mean, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right.
The situation that she's in, it's just utterly heartbreaking. Yeah. And it's almost impossible to even imagine what it would be like to be in her shoes.
Absolutely.
And so I say that as a mom and a person, just a human being.
Well, it's intensified by being a parent. There's no doubt about that.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, definitely.
Okay, so you hear that then, so 29, you heard, do you know anything about the particular kind of cancer that they said is, they said this is the worst, I don't know how many kinds of brain cancer exist, but they said, oh, this is the worst kind. They pretty much told her to go right home. That was it.
Yes.
Do you know about that particular kind?
What I know, you know, this isn't my area of specialty, but I know that it's aggressive, and I know that it's not treatable. It doesn't tend to respond to treatment. So I know that all of that was a very dire prognosis for her medically.
And they catch something, when they say aggressive, they also must have meant that not only did she get it, but it started to spread before she even knew enough of it, because, you know, I mean, you can't catch that if it's...
Yes, it grows rapidly. Okay. And so that's how they can estimate that, you know, how much time she has left, because it tends to grow rapidly and they can't do anything to stop it. So,
but when she said she knew she had, she knew something was wrong, it was already affecting her. It had already probably been going on before she knew anything, symptoms I'm talking about, I guess.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
All right. And we have no idea. Not that we could get into this, and that, you said it's not your field of expertise, but we have no idea why this happens. It's in her DNA somewhere. It has nothing to do with her, right? I mean, that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and I think if we were to tell the total truth, you know,
let's tell the total truth.
Okay. Certain cancers, you know, smoking is connected with lung cancer. You know, there are situations in which we can definitely pinpoint a cause and effect, but I think it's far more mysterious than we give credit to. Mm-hmm. You know, these illnesses that come to us, I think there's a certain element of mystery, and we have to accept that as well. We can't always figure it out. We don't always understand why. Why does someone her age get a cancer like that? So ultimately, as much as we would like to think that modern medicine can sort these questions out, we really don't know.
Well, we know that cancer is not not necessarily loyal to age anyway, right? I mean, there's no reason. There might be reasons why someone gets lung cancer if they've smoked 8 packs of cigarettes a day for 30, 20 years. But by the same token, two people can do that. And one person maybe, and they both get cancer, but one gets it when he's 70 and the other one gets it when he's what, 20? Yeah, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so in that respect, we're in the dark. Okay, I agree. It doesn't matter. I agree with you, but I felt the same way. It is heartbreaking. I was younger and I knew younger, people, friends, who, got terminal cancer and died, younger people. Mm-hmm. But for some reason or another, as bad as it seemed back then, now that I've outlived, you know, so many people, I really, it's kind of intense. It's got more of an impact that somebody that young, I'm a father too, but still, I think you know what I'm saying. I'm saying I see that 29 way different than I saw it when I was 40.
Yeah, exactly. Now that, you know, you've counted the years since then and even seen how much you've experienced and what's happened in your life and in all that time. And it's very significant.
Now, this is, I don't know where, and I haven't read enough about her. Maybe she hasn't even disclosed enough about it, but she decided at one point that she was not going to, they've already given her some kind of drugs, because I know you've seen, everybody has seen, if they've seen her, how different she looked from the pictures they showed of her when she was married, and it's not long ago. And now she's got puffy and she's gained some weight based on drugs they must have given her.
Yes, they're giving her steroids, prednisone, that's most likely to help shrink the swelling of the brain around the tumor, which to help with probably with headaches and symptoms that she would have. But the prednisone has a lot of side effects, including just edema in the body and weight gain.
And that's something, it stops swelling. And yet you swell from it.
Well, yeah, it's fluid retention in the tissues, but also weight gain.
So they did that just to ease some of the thing. But she, I don't know. She must have done some research, do you think, at what happens to people in the final, I don't even know what it would be, week of disintegration, or, you know, as you get closer to, I don't know what to call it. It's not disintegration, but I mean, she must have done some research or seen people in pain or something. Do you have experience with this at all? I mean, in terms of people who said, kill me? I mean, just get me out of here before it does this to me?
I have the sense that the doctors that she was visiting told her, but that's when, from the article that I read, that she heard from the doctors that she was likely to have severe headaches, nausea, dizziness, and other symptoms from the tumor, that was likely to happen to her. And I'm not sure if she, you know, if she also read about it. So, and I don't know for sure if she had any other experience, like with someone else in her life that she knew or had heard of. But apparently the picture that she was given was very dire and drastic.
Well, before she moved, she decided to move in, to Oregon, because she was in a state where you could you couldn't do self-assisted suicides. But what do you, you've been with many people? Let's just refresh everyone who hadn't heard you on the shows before. You spent a great deal of time dealing with people who were dealing with the death they knew that was coming shortly.
Yes.
And these are people of all ages, as I remember.
Yes.
What, how, where does she fit into, can you give us an idea of somebody of that age that you dealt with who knew they were going to die?
Yes, I have had a few patients in their 20s who were dying of different types of cancer, some melanoma, some the lymphomas in the blood cancers. Mm-hmm. And then also some patients, I had a couple of patients with HIV back before we had all the medications we have now. Mm-hmm. who were dying of AIDS, who were in their 20s. So I did have patients, dealt with patients who were that young, who were dying. And I had a patient with the same type of brain tumor that she had, man who was in his 40s, who was dying of that.
And these people just died. What I'm going to ask you is, without getting any more depressing or graphic, at least I don't want to bum everyone out, because it's a terrible thing in the first place, but what... did you experience them very close to death, or what happened to them? Would you think that would be something that she would be, because she's afraid to go through? She doesn't want to. She just says, "I don't want to go through all this." Did these people, when you were watching this happen, was it like, "Oh boy, could they just put them away?" Or I mean, what did they go through in your experience?
You know, I think it's our human nature to fear death, and I think that any one of us who had, especially a cancer diagnosis, would have some fear about that, like, oh my goodness, what does that mean? What will happen to me? And what I saw, our role as hospice caregivers coming in to help take care of the patient, and my role as a physician, would be to go in and say, this is what we know about. This is what we deal with. We help people at this, who are at this place, and we're good at it. And we know how to help you with the symptoms that you will have. You're not alone. We will be here with you every step of the way. And we've seen everything. We've seen all of it. We know what's there. We know how to deal with this, and we're not going to abandon you, and we are going to stick with you. We will find a way. So we come in kind of as the reassurance for that person that, you know, one thing that happens to people with cancer who maybe have been in treatment, they've had this, an oncologist who's worked with them and said, I know what to do for you. I know how to help you. I've helped people be cured, and so I know what to do. And suddenly when that oncologist decides, okay, nothing that I knew how to do has worked, and I can't do anything more for you, that's frightening for people to hear, because this was the person they counted on who had the answer for them. So they feel very abandoned and alone out there, like, what do I do now? And that's why when we come in as hospice, we become the authorities who know how to help people. So I think that's the role that I embraced, at least, that we need to come in and reassure people we will not leave you alone and you by yourself. You know, we won't leave you, abandon you. Mm-hmm. We're here for you, and we will do everything that we know of that we can find to be of help to you no matter what happens. So with that reassurance, that seemed to make a big difference to a lot of patients who felt a little bit more comfortable and calmer once they knew, okay, I have help. There's a team here. These people are with me. They will help me. And I will say the younger people that I worked with, many of them went through a phase of real anger and bitterness because they were young and because they felt like, I haven't even had a chance to live my life yet. And so that's something many of them needed to process, like getting through the anger so that they could come out on the other side and say, okay, but I still have a little time left. What do I want to do with that time that's left to me?
And I was going to ask you about that, because you obviously know, and I don't know, I can't recite them, but you said about young people being angry, and yet anger is one of the five steps. Are there five steps to the death? What is it? Anger, denial, acceptance. You know the five? Is it five or four?
Yes, according to, that's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's
Some
people. Yeah, anger, depression, bargaining.
Bargaining, right, and then?
And acceptance, not necessarily in that order.
It's only four. What do you mean not in that order? You mean you could accept it and then get angry?
No, I mean acceptance is the last stage.
I just wondering.
Goes through all five stages.
Darn it, I accept it now and I can't. So when you say they're angry because they're young, is that part of the process of that they're going through? Because, I mean, you get angry if you're 60 and you go through these stages, according to her, right?
Sure. But I think for us, for the young people, it was a different kind of anger of really feeling cheated by life here. Like,
yeah.
Oh, gosh, there's so much I didn't get to experience in this lifetime. So some of our work was just helping them with that, helping them process that. So how do you make the most of what you do have, even though you are, you know, you're so aware of what you've lost and what won't be there for you?
But you're not lying to them. I mean, they're correct, and they're correct. And isn't it is it not therapeutic to say to them, you're darn right, you got cheated, and now let's see, right? Because, I mean, you can't talk them out of it.
Oh, no, exactly. Right. That's exactly. Yeah. You validate their anger because right. They have good reason to feel that way. But, you know, well, one young man was so angry, he was taking it out on his mother and sisters who were taking care of him. And he would yell at them and swear at them and throw things at them. And just to ventilate his own anger about what was happening. And I finally, after observing that for a while and just seeing how devastating it was for his family who were just there being so loving to him, I asked him, I said, just think about what do you want your mom and your sisters to remember about you? How do you want them to think of you after you're gone? And he stopped for a minute and it completely changed what he was thinking, because he said, I don't want them to remember me the way I've been, the way I have treated them. I don't want that. And so I said, then you have a choice. You know, you can decide to move on. You have a reason to be angry, but you could decide to move on from it. And you could participate in this love that they're trying to shower you with and be part of that with them and love them in return. And that's what they will remember. And that helped him make that transition and realize that, you know what, being angry at some point wasn't helping him anyway. Like, he was ready to let go of that and accept what was happening.
I think, like, push come to shove, we're all pretty, anyone who's alive And I don't know what else you would be, I mean, to be even thinking this. Anyone who is alive is kind of a crackpot when it comes to this stuff anyway, because, you know, there's an old Jewish joke, the two old Jewish ladies. I don't know why they're Jewish ladies. I guess they could be Italian ladies or Polish. No, let's make them Jewish ladies. That's the original joke. You have two Jewish ladies who go to Klumsky's, and they said, let's go to Klumsky's for lunch. And he goes, oh, Klumsky's. Well, I go to Klumsky's. She says, the chicken's always so greasy, and the mashed potatoes are soggy, and the crumpkin and the tea is cold. And then the other one goes, yes, and such small portions. Which I guess really explains a lot about how we feel. You know, life is painful, and there's all this stuff we go through and everything. And then what does it all mean if we are suddenly faced with the end of it? We, you know, then all of a sudden we realize, God, that was horrible, but there were such small portions of it.
Just before, wait, why can't I have more of this?
Yeah, so I mean, even the thought of it, and so much goes through me, when so much was, I was affected so greatly when I saw this particular story. And I don't know why, because I have actually, like I said, I've outlived. I've been with people who have, just, you know, got it and died. And I've, you know, the part of me that is just a selfish human being, as they say, you know, went like, well, you know, really, I really feel horrible. And then, you know, inside you're like, I'm glad it's not me. You know, it's because we're clinging. I know I do. You know, I mean, I'm like, I really cling to life. Like, I don't know what happens. The worst can happen. And still I look at that, ability to live through it as an incredible thing. You know, it's still better than the alternative.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's where each one of us struggles with her decision. Mm-hmm. is first of all, could or would any one of us make the same decision? Like, what kind of courage does it take to make that choice that she did? I mean, to end her life, if she carries it out, I guess that's the thing we don't know for sure. She set a date and has a plan and has the medication. But I guess for me, as a hospice doctor, because I've been with many, many people at the end of life, many, many people who were told you only have 2 weeks or 6 weeks or 6 months to live. And I've seen many of them get better and outlive that prognosis that they were given and kind of have a little second chance at extra days of life. Mm-hmm. And for those people, it was very special, a very special time. And so, personally, I don't want to see anyone miss out on the opportunity to have that, to maybe have a reprieve, to maybe have it not be as bad as it could possibly be, you know, to maybe have a miracle or maybe have something happen that it wouldn't be as bad as we know it possibly could be. So that part of me says, oh my gosh, don't throw away the chance that something good could happen in the midst of all this.
Well, that would lead us into all sorts of other ways of looking at this. But I guess if she looked at, I'm sure that before she came public about this, she probably, dare I say, I mean, really weighed, I mean, she really handicapped the situation. It's like, well, let's look at people who specifically have this kind of cancer. What are the odds of that? I mean, what are the chances? And doctors don't give you odds, they give you chances, but it's the same thing. So she must know that there's a very small, if not, rate of miracle in this case.
Yeah.
Right?
I assume that someone.
Yeah, we are assuming, but I mean, do you not have any statistics on any, like when you said there were people who were given, I mean, couldn't that just be a doctor who was, I don't know, miscalculated or something, or how?
Well,
they died anyway, right? I mean, they give you a month and you get a year, you still die of the same thing.
Yeah, but we're all going to die for one thing or something. So, you know, 100% of us will die. So that's a given for sure.
But we're not acting like them. We're not, you know, I mean, a lot, you, maybe people should, but they're not.
Yeah. Well, so here's one thing I can quote to you that, studies that have been done, because all the other stories and those things I'm mentioning, they're all just anecdotes. That's just what I've seen with my own eyes, which is what partly, you know, makes me want to say, oh, I wish you could hang on a little bit longer just in case, you know, that's because of what I've seen with my own eyes. But in studies, they have shown when they've taken lung cancer patients and, half of them got hospice care and half of them got standard treatment for their lung cancer. The hospice patients stopped treatment and didn't get any more treatment for their cancer. They just went into hospice, and the hospice patients lived on average 29 days longer than the patients who were just continued chemotherapy and got standard treatment. So anyway, I know it sounds like, oh, so big deal, 29 days, but, you know, 29 days could mean a lot. A lot can happen in 29 days. And that's, so that for me is partly why I've done the work that I've done, mm-hmm. is to help people have as many extra days as they could have, to make those days be as good as they possibly could be, and to assist those people and help them with their symptoms so that they could have as much quality as possible during those last days, knowing they will die anyway. They'll die anyway, whether they die this month or next month. But for many people, at least, 29 extra days is significant. It means a lot to see your, you know, to see your family and your loved ones for 29 more days. So I don't know. That's a study that's been done. Mm. So that's definitely data that's factual.
I tend to think of these things probably maybe too dramatically in one sense, but I think of how there are things. Now, let's just move away from cancer. We all know we got a problem with that, and we all know people are dying every day of cancer and heart disease, and things are just clicking. But there were does anybody realize how many people died of what? Of the rheumatism, or died of high fevers, or died of tuberculosis, or died of things that are now taken care of with the greatest of ease? What about all those people? I think about those people. I mean, I really do. I think, wow, look at even King Tut. How old was he? I mean, there was nothing at one point to help people. Some people got real sick and died of what? Look at pneumonia. I mean, people still die of pneumonia, but right? I mean, the care that we have, and I don't even want to go into, you know, the new stuff. I mean, the Ebola thing. I mean, new viruses or things that go around. And that's not new, but. Right? I mean, 29 days, are you sitting, 30 days, 40 days, are you sitting, isn't it a little, I guess I'm taking her side here, isn't it a little foolish to say, well, I'll take another day of absolute complete pain like I've never experienced in my life, because tomorrow, in the news, someone's going to say, hey, if you just inject this into her head, she'll be fine. Right? I mean, and other people are trying to make them accept the fact that they're going to die, which we're going to die anyway, then what happens in that extra time? Is that really for anyone else? What's that for? Who is that for?
Well, you know, what I've experienced with people through hospice is that a lot can happen in that extra time and in the last months of life. And so a lot of forgiveness, a lot of relationships get healed. People have sometimes like spiritual experiences and kind of awaken to, you know, to a higher consciousness during that time. So those are the things that I really value when I see that kind of healing taking place. And I don't know if, you know, not everyone values that, and not everyone even probably believes in that or sees that as important. But for me, that's what I've witnessed that seems it seems like important when people are given an extra opportunity to have some of those experiences at the end of life.
Yeah, I'm trying to look at, you know, I try to look at these things from all different angles without being judgmental here and there. But, and I just know that from my own angle, someone would say, look, I've been alive 10 more days than I thought, and I'm getting a higher consciousness. Now, I would say, can I get the highest consciousness and stay here? I mean, I still wouldn't be satisfied. Maybe that's non-acceptance. Is that non-acceptance? Is that denial? What is that? Tell me, Doc.
A bit unaccepting, but you know,
what's wrong with me?
The other side of the coin that I want to make sure I say is that no part of me whatsoever judges Brittany Maynard for her decision. For one thing, I'm not in her shoes, and I really don't know what it would be like to be her. I don't know what she's already experienced, what she may the pain she may already have gone through, you know, and so I don't judge her at all. I just want to make that clear.
I didn't mean to put you in the position that where you were taking her side or not.
I just wanted that to be clear that, you know, I support the fact that she has the right to make this choice, and I am sure it was an agonizingly difficult choice to make. And so I would just, you know, support her with tremendous compassion and love for doing this, but and also for having the courage to stand up and talk about it.
Yeah.
Be interviewed by People Magazine and, you know, CBS News, and go out there in the world and let people know, knowing that it's really controversial and not everyone agrees with her. And
yeah, well, what a stance to take, the final stance right there, if she's going to take any kind of stance politically or whatever. Well, and then we'll talk about more about that and about the why people would be for or against it and the law itself when we come back. But we're not going to leave. I'm not going to break away as I usually do here. This is Cotolo Chronicles. Dr. Karen Wyatt is with us today to talk about this death with dignity issue and... I was going to say Karen. It's not Karen. It's Brittany Maynard, who has been in the news. But instead of breaking for any kind of public service and stuff like that, let's go. Let's do a Dr. Karen Wyatt commercial here at the top of the hour, because the book is. I've told people about it. Let's tell them about it again. What Really Matters is still available at Amazon, correct?
Yes.
Isn't it? You have a digital version of it there too, I hope?
Yes, it's a Kindle ebook. And actually, right now, briefly, until I remember to go on and change it, it's only 99 cents, the ebook on Kindle. What a bargain.
I know. And it's true. You know, I got a book on, I just started to get some royalty checks for my book I have on there. And I don't know what anybody can learn from anything I write, but for gosh sakes, it's more than that. And so go get What Really Matters, because I'm tired of loaning it to some of you people. It's not it's not fair to the author, okay? It's available in Kindle. And as I said at the beginning of the show, if you don't have a Kindle, there are people who know how to get you to read those things on your iPhone or what have you. Now also, I'm still interested in Enough of It? No, wait, I forgot the name of it now. I don't have it in front of me. Get Over It, right?
Get Over It.
Get Over It is the home, the home game version of going to a shrink. Your home game version is Get Over It. Tell us again, tell everybody again. We could all get this and where they can get it or what have you on your website. To tell them about this, because I've told a lot of people about this. And as you know, we posted things and told, you tell them about it.
All right. It is, it's a home study course that you can take. And it's basically helping people just heal hidden wounds from childhood. Sometimes it's some of the things that we're all carrying around with us, baggage that we're carrying around that we don't really think about that often. We're not really aware. So I'm not necessarily talking, you know, some people are dealing with major trauma issues, and they may need therapy for that. But this is for those of us who've had other issues in childhood just that have become obstacles to us in our relationships, in how we're dealing with life. And so my example was that I was hospitalized with encephalitis when I was a 9-month-old baby, which I don't remember anything about it. And yet what I know neurologically, that experience probably had a great effect on me mm-hmm. at that age and has led to certain fears and anxieties that I have. And I can fix those by going back and just understanding where they came from. So this is a home study course that people can do to just learn about themselves, to learn about, it helps walk you through the developmental stages of childhood and talks about some of the common wounds that each one of us receives just in normal childhood, and then some ideas for just how to heal it and how to let go of it and move on and clear those up. And it's at overitforgood.com is the URL where you can find that course.
It would also help you if let's say you don't think you have anything, any problem, because a lot of people don't do these things because they go like, there's nothing wrong with me, right? If you take it, you might be able to see certain things you hadn't seen before, correct?
Yes, exactly. Because we walk through, I actually have people create a kind of a family timeline where they go back, and you might even need to interview people in your family about, so what was going on when I was a baby, and even finding out, you know, what was happening for your parents, what was going on in their lives, because it helps you understand where your parents may not have been able to be fully present for you at that particular time. Like one woman I worked with found out that her mother's mother died when she was just an infant, and her mother was grieving for a couple of years while she was an infant. And that had a big impact on her and how loved she felt as a baby, because her mom was emotionally just not there. She was dealing with a lot of pain and grief. So anyway, it's something that you may not ever have thought about before. It may not have occurred to you that there are issues there. So working through the process helps you find those hidden factors that are having an influence on you.
That's like so important. I think that is great. I think that's a great thing to be able to look for. I don't know how many people find out things, no less do I know how many people never find out things or never seek the importance of various events or things that happened, and just like walk through life and live with such pain and are very happy to pass it around to other people. But I guess we all know that, and I'm sorry to laugh at that, but I'm an idiot when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I think that this is great. I'm surprised like a ton of people haven't done this kind of stuff. I forgot this guy's name now. It just came to my mind. There was a great psychiatrist guy. He used to be on, the network, on a network talk show. And he had a book. I went through the book. And it was a book where you would go through and answer questions and then what have you. And then you would find out stuff. But yours is... then the only other thing I know that is like the product that's out there.
Yeah. And the ultimate outcome of it at the very end, after we've gathered all this information, we draw this timeline of kind of how life has gone and what's happened in life. Then we trace the threads of, I can trace the threads from being in the hospital at 9 months of age through various other experiences of my life and see, aha, this was part of that experience and it was part of that experience. But ultimately, the conclusion you come to at the very end is that all of these parts of yourself, all of these things that have happened in your life are actually what have made you the person you are today. And you end up finding a way to think, wow, I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for everything that happened to me because this helped shape me. This helped create who I am. So suddenly you don't have to reject that part of yourself anymore. You can you can embrace it and just kind of love who you are and love how you got here and how you ended up and what how unique you are as a person.
Well, you just spread the blame around, I guess. Yeah. In other words, well, I mean, can't this also bring up things? Well, obviously it can, right? This can also bring up things, which is good to do, whether it's anger or depression or, depression, same thing.
A lot of times, right? if that anger is there and it's been hidden and locked away, yeah, it causes other problems. Right. So like that kind of suppressed anger can cause health problems, mm-hmm, psychological problems. It can cause relationship problems. So it really does need to be explored in order to get over it so that it doesn't impact your life negatively anymore.
And I wonder what a species. But I don't want to go there. Don't you ever wonder if there's life on other planets, if these people have gone through this? People, I say people. If these things have gone through this stuff or that's weird. But we're going to talk about that too, because I guess when we talk about the death with dignity issue, we're going to have to bring up, well, I'm going to take sides or talk about it, but we're going to have to bring up it in a political realm, because it's only... And let's go back, and let's do that. Okay, so everybody go to over it.
Over it for good.
Over it for good.
Over it for good.
.com, right?
.com, that's right.
And you're at Dr. Is it Dr. Karen Wyatt .com? No, or is it just Karen Wyatt?
It's Karen Wyatt MD.com.
MD. That's right. Of course, it'd have to be there at one place. And then you could find out more about all the other stuff and Amazon for What Really Matters. And What Really Matters is, we really didn't say what that is. Those are stories that you have of your experiences with people dying, right?
Yes. Okay. Stories of patients I took care of in hospice and really the lessons I learned from them about life lessons and how to live life and what really matters in life. So that's the essence of it.
Hence comes the title, What Really Matters. And it's good. It was, and what I like about that book too is that you don't have to, you could put it down, read another book, go back. Well, I could do that anyway, but I mean, you know, you pick it up, read those stories separately. Anyway, okay, so there you go, Dr. Karen Wyatt. Now, let's look at this death with dignity thing. Karen, I called, you're Karen.
I'm Karen, yeah.
Brittany must have thought about this. Now let's go back to where this really became an issue. That was with the good old Jack Kevorkian.
Yes.
So when that was going on, and they were grabbing him and saying, "You can't do that. Get out," you know, and putting him in. He went to jail for it. This guy, talk about conviction. You know, when he had the deathmobile, he drove around in that thing where he could just, you know, park in the driveway. He did it in the sly and everything because he really felt as a doctor that people would have the right to say, like, I don't want to go through this anymore. When that was really that was before there was any law. Now, there are only three states now that have where it's legal to do that. What was your experience with him? I'm not with him, you weren't with him, but I mean, when that started, how did you feel about it, how it was done or what it meant and why they were persecuting him?
Well, personally, I mean, I did a little bit of reading in retrospect about Jack Kevorkian and what motivated him. And I don't know. I felt a little uneasy about him. Like, why was he so motivated to do this? I don't know, I didn't feel 100% on his side, just personally.
He did look like a little mad scientist in a way, didn't he?
And I read that he was obsessed with death, that he's been obsessed for a number of years with death. And so that bothered me a little bit. And
we don't know much about his life. Do you know anything about his life before he got into all this?
Just what I read didn't make me feel comfortable. Mm. You know, it didn't make me feel comfortable that he was some sort of Mother Teresa kind of person who was out there out of tremendous, you know, compassion and love for people wanting to help them, that there was something a little bit sinister
you think he was getting his jollies too? I mean, he really enjoyed, or it was a power trip or something?
I don't know for sure.
But that's what you felt?
I did read that there were some controversial cases where there were questions about whether or not some of the people that he assisted to die actually had a terminal diagnosis. Some of the people were thought to have been depressed, who probably should have had some kind of psychiatric help and didn't get it. This is what I read, mm-hmm. which, who knows, the person who wrote this might have been biased against him anyway. Yeah. But that raised questions for me. So it raised questions for me about him and his integrity. And understanding that the people who sought help from him were desperate and really, you know, desperate for some kind of answer, some kind of help and some kind of way out. So it's nothing on them. I just didn't feel 100% clear about him, what his intentions and motivations were. But he raised a lot of controversy.
Regardless of his whatever, if there were any deep, you know, psychological agendas we don't know about, regardless of that, and regardless of the fact that back then, I mean, there are people said, like you said, maybe there were people he helped to die that weren't totally, or just thought they were terminal, or. And that could have been a mistake. As we were talking about before, right? I mean, some guy could have, I mean, a doctor could have told this guy, you're going to die. And maybe he was wrong, right? Okay.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the call to Kevorkian, and then he comes over, and whether he enjoyed it or not, or it doesn't matter. Maybe, I guess what I'm saying is that ultimately it might be a moot point. Do you know if there was anyone else doing that kind of thing? Or did he just become the star of that particular...
Not that I know of for sure, but I mean, it could have been happening behind the scenes somewhere. Right. Someone who was never found out about and never in the spotlight for what was happening. It's possible.
And that's breaking the oath, right? He broke his oath, right?
Yeah, well, that is an issue, I think, for doctors. Like this oath of do no harm, you know, that...
You took it. You took it, right? You're a doctor. What exactly? Tell us the oath. We don't know.
I can't even remember it. I'd have to.
Well, even paraphrase it. You just started to do something like it.
I think. Well, see, I can't. Gosh, it's been a lot of years since I said
that. I'll do no harm. I won't. What?
It's not doing harm for people to do to the best of your ability to help people. But honestly, I should Google it so I'd know. I should have looked that up. If you had told me.
Well, I am sorry. Everyone else, you can do it. Everyone knows what to do after the show. They got a little notebook. They write down what we don't go into and they go look and search for it. So they'll do that. I know they'll write it down, everybody, right now. But the oath doesn't say, but even though, so then when a doctor tells you, I had a friend, let me go get this whole thing into perspective, that four incomplete sentences that I just made. I had a friend who had a problem and eventually went to the doctor and they did some tests and the doctor said, you know, you might as well go home and make yourself comfortable. Now, at that point, this doctor, is he breaking his oath? Is he something we've done everything we can do. It's out of my hands. Go home and die. And I've heard lots of stories like that, you know, where the doctor just tells you to go home. Now, is that doing everything you could do? I mean, I would sit there and question the doctor. I would say, hey, hold on a second. Get out that oath. What do you mean? There's nothing else? That's it? So aren't you breaking your oath by saying you've done, that's it? You're not even going to try anything else? You know how people run to get Andy Kaufman, that comedian back in the 80s, who got that strange form of lung cancer or what have you, and, you know, went down to Mexico. You know how people, Steve McQueen went down to Mexico. He had a strange form of lung cancer. And then, you know, they went down to these places where you could, you'll get these, whether they worked or not, but these desperate means of medicine and what have you. And, did you see the Dallas Buyers Club?
No, I didn't see that.
You should see that because when you talk about HIV and AIDS, because there were many things that supposedly were available that the FDA didn't approve up here. So there's a lot of people might have died, way too soon had the. What I'm saying is that people went down to do these other, you know, go elsewhere to try to save or extend their lives. So what about when a doctor says, hey, that's it. I wipe my hand. They drew the old Pontius Pilate on you. Isn't that wrong?
Well, I mean, if there were other treatments available and the doctor said, that's it, I'm not doing anything more for you, yes, I think that would be wrong. But there are cases when there is nothing more that can be done that the doctor knows about or feels comfortable with. So if you understand, Western medical doctors are trained in rational, evidence-based scientific medicine. So everything, the treatments that they recommend for the most part have been studied, you know, and there's evidence that it works. So that's kind of the criteria for most doctors. They need to know that there's evidence that what they recommend has been helpful, and they base their treatments on that. And so a lot of alternative treatments haven't been studied in that rigorous way, and they just, so doctors will not recommend that because it isn't part of what's acceptable to them as a possible treatment.
Okay, then let's not squander any time on that particular point. Let's go to the point that if this is a good thing, well, let's not even judge the doing this and the right to do it. The people who would be against death with dignity are obviously the people who have moral imperatives. Would I be going out on a limb to say that?
No, I think that's true. I think that's what it comes down to, that for some people, it definitely represents suicide, which they feel, you know, violates their morals or their religious beliefs.
Okay. So they don't want, and they don't feel, and then the other ones, of course, don't feel that the government should have anything to do with that anyway. But I guess that means you should be able to do it if you want. I don't know. Then you draw the line between like being a libertarian and a conservative. Because when a libertarian say like, hey, you want to kill yourself? Go kill yourself, you know? But a conservative or a real conservative might say, no, you can't do that because it's not, you know, let God take its course. And, right? But a doctor's never going to say that. A doctor lets you go. He says, you know, a doctor's never going to say God. Let God take his course. I mean, they don't cross that line. This would be okay with doctors? Or have you read anything about how doctors feel about this? Yeah, that's a good question.
I think it's very controversial. I think there would be a lot of doctors who would say, I don't feel comfortable. I don't want to be the person who writes the prescription that I know will take someone's life. I don't want to be the person who instructs them in how to take this medication that's going to kill you. Because I think for a lot of doctors, that would violate their own ethics and principles. And they feel like, I'm here to help you live, not to help you die. So I cannot, you know, I couldn't do it. I couldn't cross that line and write the prescription.
For me, that's like if you're a lawyer, and lawyers all don't just follow the instructions of their clients. They also consult and give them the best possible advice they can for what they need to do. So if you're a lawyer who writes a will, to me, the doctor, as you're saying, the doctor saying, I won't do anything like that, to me is like a lawyer who's working on a will for somebody. And the somebody, his client, says, I want to leave my collection of antique cars to my son. And the lawyer would go, really? Your son? You want to leave all those cars to your son? Don't you think you know what I'm saying? It was like, the advice is like, isn't the same thing as telling him, you really want to leave all that stuff to him? Why don't you? They're giving them advice based on their professional
acumen. You know, the doctor's ability to write the prescription like we have prescriptive authority. That is the one thing that the doctor possesses that no one else has, is that ability to write the prescription. And so that's the power that we have in our situation. But to use our power in a way that we know is going to be to lead to the death of a patient. For probably many doctors, it's just not acceptable. It's not something that doctor could live with.
So what is this? So then this is an issue. This is an individual issue. Is it a ethical issue? Is it a moral issue? With doctors, doctors are not necessarily, as you said, you know, doctors are clinical. They're very scientific. They need evidence of this, that, and the other thing. Well, and they're also pretty good at sticking to what they feel is the result of any particular diagnosis. So if the person's going to die and they admit they're going to die and they say, no, you're going to die. There's no doubt about you're going to die. How you die is this way. You will painfully fall into things and lapses a thing and something. Or I could just give you something and you'll die anyway. Okay, and I'm not playing devil's advocate here, but you're a doctor. I mean, and I'm saying, if I was a doctor, I would say, like, well, what's the difference?
Well, because, you know, because we carry with us this responsibility for other people's lives, and that's our job, to be responsible for other people in the decisions that we make, and how we practice, what we recommend. And we've spent a lot of years studying to have that responsibility in our hands. So it's very serious. And
but when does it cross the line of being a moral imperative? I mean, you're being moral about this. You. I mean, doctors are being moral about this. What are they saying? Or is this just a rule? Look, no, doctors don't do this, so that's the end of it. It's our rules, and we stick with our rules, and that's the end of it. Or we can't do that because it's just not right. When all of a sudden something's not right, you know what I mean? Isn't that a moral imperative?
Well, I would think, I mean, if Brittany Maynard has a right to decide she's going to take medication to end her life, then I think doctors have a right to say, I won't be the one who prescribes that medication. I'm not judging her. She's welcome to take it. It's legal. She can do it. But I'm not comfortable being the one who writes it. I think the doctor at some point should have a right to say, for me, that crosses the line, and I don't want that. I don't want her death on my conscience. I don't want to carry that with me. I don't want that. So
in many states, and I don't know if they've wiped it from the legislation in states where death would dignity is now legal, three states, Vermont, Oregon, and where? What's the other one?
Washington.
But suicide, as dumb as this might sound, I know this is against the law.
Yes.
This is like, and people laugh when they hear that. They go like, what do you mean? The guy kills himself. What do they do? Put his body in jail? I mean, what do they do? All right, no funeral for you. You broke the law. That's it. I mean, it means that if you attempt it and they decide that you attempt it, okay, well, forget about attempting. The point is that's against the law. So therefore, the law itself is saying you can't kill yourself. And if that's the law, you'd think a doctor would say, hey, it's against the law for you to kill yourself. So me killing you, helping you die is against the law. That would just seem to be the best excuse, wouldn't it?
Well, yeah, that happened is true in other states, that it is against the law for the doctor. You know, that's why Kevorkian
yes.
went to jail, because it's against the law to assist a person in committing an illegal act like that. So that's one, that's one reason.
But doesn't that go back to why is that a law? That's a law because somewhere down the line, there has to be, in this country, you know, where money still says in God we trust, somewhere down the line, there's going to be making these laws based on some dictum and some dogma somewhere.
Yeah, and I think we've had a lot of laws, you know, over time like that we've had to reevaluate, you know, that end up having to be examined and, you know, some of them thrown out and rewritten. over time. And chances are, like, that's one of the things that's so important about this case is it's bringing so much attention to it. It's bringing it up everywhere, so people are talking about it and looking at it. And that's what we really need. We need to examine those laws and understand, do they make sense? Is that really the way that we want to treat people and want to operate?
But still going to be, it's never going to be a decision of the state. It's not like, you know how they went crazy, the people who were opposed to social medicine, to the Affordable Care Act. Remember in the beginning when they said, like, well, you know, the government's eventually going to say, no for you, die. And they're eventually going to give you, you know, a death sentence, that absurdity. That all comes from the same mentality that somewhere along the line said, you know, not only you can't kill yourself, of course, that's why they call it death with dignity, because it's the decision. It's all put in front. You don't have to sit in the back of the back, get into a closet and blow your brains out, right? It's done like, you know, you're going to sleep. The way they put down criminals in death, they don't use electric chair anymore, do they? I don't think they use it anymore.
I don't know. They may in some states. I'm not sure about that.
Because it's done the same way, right? There's this concoction, this cocktail of deadly chemicals. Which where am I going with this? I'll tell you where I'm going with this. I'm going to tell everyone here. This is Cthulhu Chronicles, and Dr. Karen Wyatt, who's making far more sense than I am in this. But we're trying to discuss this from. But that's what's good about me is I can act as the voice of many of you and ask all these questions and play the devil's advocate along the way, because I don't really know. I don't really have a good opinion on this. And you're a doctor and you don't, because like you said, you suddenly become a person when this becomes a decision, right? It's like,
yeah, it's hard. Hard to just take an unemotional stance on the issue and not feel all the aspects of it.
But so many people do. So many people do. That's the point. This became a law because there were people who were disconnected, people fighting against it politically, certainly aren't thinking, well, what would I do if I were in her shoes? They're thinking on this, you know, on this plane, this social, moral plane of us as humans, or, you know, and what laws and dogmas we follow and things and spiritual stuff. They're thinking of themselves. That's if they were, maybe they would think differently.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because, well, you mentioned like the uproar over the Affordable Care Act, and the only thing in the Affordable Care Act that led to all of that talk about death panels was that doctors would get paid for talking to patients about the end of life, and that maybe in states, I mean, maybe there would be discussions about how far do we go with treatment, because we know that a lot of the Medicare dollars being spent on too much treatment, too much aggressive treatment at the end of life, you know, mm-hmm. So that there would be groups to talk about that, to talk about how can we, you know, how can we look at that differently. But anyway, it created a huge uproar, and, you know, that people felt threatened that somehow the government now, like you said, would be deciding people should die. Well, doctors are pretty afraid of all of that. They don't want to step in the middle of all that fray, and they don't want to be accused of deciding that someone should die or, you know, participating in it. I think that's another part of it that's difficult for doctors. We don't necessarily want to be involved in the politics of it.
But you are involved in talking those particular conversations, and that process of talking about end of life existed before there was the Affordable Care Act. They're just saying, presenting a fact of treatments and talk about treatment that's already there.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Exactly. It just got blown out of proportion.
Well, of course.
But that's what our society does.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think that is what's happening with this issue too.
Yes. Right? Because this is now, and I guess this, does this fall into the conflagration of people, of attitudes in abortion?
You know, I would think so. I would think it's in the same kind of category, mm-hmm. you know, the right to life category, mm-hmm. and the sense that no one has a right to play God and no one has a right to take away a life, including a person to take their own life. So you know, I would think it's in that same camp.
And that's absurd too, though, because in a sense, if you don't have, by taking away a right, I mean, what right do you have to take away a right of a person and legislate it? And they're saying, and the people who are against it are saying, well, what right do you have to make that a right? You know, that's absurd, this whole thing?
I think that is the basic issue it comes down to. Right? Is it a right or not? Do you have a right to decide when your life should end or not? You know, is that, should that be in your hands? Do you have a right to make that choice?
Well, the fact that you can do it. The
fact that you can, yeah.
Gives you the right. It's, you know, this stuff about, they're very quick to say, some people in some camps of schools of thought are quick to say that, you know, you have God-given rights. And there are no God-given rights. I mean, in essence, there's no list of God-given rights. Where are their God-given rights? In essence, the human race deals with stuff the way it does. If there were God-given rights, then a lot of things would be illegal per se. But if a person can do something, then a person to themselves, as in suicide, or a woman who says, who it's her body, she's the one, she's the machine nurturing the thing. Why would anyone else have anything to say? They would legislate that, but they would not legislate the right. You see what I'm saying? Isn't that nuts?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting conundrum that we're in, mm-hmm. you know, with all these just controversial opinions about things, and we're really a divided country right now, I think, you know, at odds with each other in how to think about this and how to think about what rights human beings actually have.
But if we're divided now, it's only because in the past the stuff was ignored or it was taken as, you know, law was taken by, because people didn't know as much. What I'm saying is, I think that if we were divided now, it's because there was a certain stupidity that kept us united.
Exactly.
You're right?
Well, a stupidity and, yeah, not even having the kinds of choices that we have now.
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't asking you to judge it like I did. Stupidity. I called it stupidity. I didn't mean to get you editorial, but you know what I mean, right? Didn't have the choices. So the people who said, you don't do that because it's wrong. God says it's wrong. Okay, that's it. Goodbye. There's no abortions. There's no nothing. There's no suicides. Correct?
Yeah. But, I mean, not, but there were. Those all did exist in the past too, but it was a little bit more, it was easier to be black and white, I think, in the past. Nowadays, we have so many choices, we have the capabilities of so many things, and it's a lot tougher, you know, it's tougher for us to sort it all out.
We're with Dr. Karen Wyatt here in Cthulhu Chronicles on October, this is the penultimate October show we're doing. And what have you been doing since? Have you been doing this kind of work since we last talked or since you were last here? What else have you been doing?
Yeah, I'm doing something very interesting now that applies to what we're talking about right now. I am doing an online interview series. And so I interview people who work in different areas of the end of life and all kinds of people, really interesting. I do 2 interviews a month and post them online. And then in November, I'm doing something called Death Expo, where all the interviews I've done in the past are going to be posted for 4 days. Anyone can listen to those. And I'll be, each day of the 4 days, I'll be doing 1 or 2 featured interviews with people about the end of life, new interviews to listen to. So it's really interesting material.
Death Expo. Where will Death Expo? That's a great title too. That's going to catch some attention. That's good marketing there, doctor. Where is that? Where is that again? Tell us more about Death online. Expo.
It's online. It's at deathexpo.com. I'm gonna write this down. And so it'll be an entirely online experience. People can register for it. Each day of the 4 days that it goes on, they'll get an email that tells them how to access all the interviews that are posted for that day. It's all free. All they have to do is register, and they can go online and take their pick of interviews they'd like to listen to. And so I have 6 different categories of interviews they can listen to. So if they're interested in one particular area, they could listen to all the interviews in that area, or they can just pick and choose what appeals to them.
When is this?
So it's November 13th through the 16th for those 4 days. That's Thursday through Sunday. And all in all, there will be about 30 interviews available that people can listen to. So if somebody really wanted to do a marathon, they could go on and listen to all 30 interviews in 4 days.
Wow, that's a binge.
That's
good. Binging's in these days on those kind of stuff, that kind of stuff. And another book, another thing, or another, what else? I mean, that's a lot.
But yeah, that it keeps me busy, but it's really fun. It's very fun. And I am writing another book. It's kind of a sequel to the book I just wrote, but I am very slow. I don't know when it will be done. I'm keeping busy, so I
just, are these more stories or what?
Yes, it's more stories, and they're actually not about hospice anymore, because so the other half of my life I do hospice work, and then I also have worked in like homeless shelters and clinics for the uninsured. So it's taking the same 7 lessons that were in What Really Matters, mm-hmm. and applying those lessons to the other work I did in the rest of my life, working with other patients, with homeless people and victims of domestic violence. So anyway, new stories from a new setting, but the same lessons and how they played out in that setting.
If this isn't too personal, let me ask you something. All of this stuff is so, not, I don't want to say stressful, but it's, I don't even want to say dark, but I guess it seems stressful. It's just dramatic. You live in, your profession constantly puts you in a position of dealing with dramatic and excessive emotional problems. What do you do? I mean, how do you? Do you just get used to that? Maybe I should. Your doctor's the same way, right? Doctors who's always seeing sick people and stuff. How do you get used to something like that?
Well, for me, it's sort of what I was called to do, I think. And if you know me very well, you know I'm extremely calm. I'm a very calm person, yeah. And I have. Oh, I always manage to have equanimity in difficult situations. And for some reason, throughout my training, no matter where I worked, I was always attracted to the most difficult patients. I was always the most interested in the patients that other doctors couldn't stand to take care of. And, the other doctors said, oh my gosh, no, not that person. That was always the patient that fascinated me, that I wanted to get to know and wanted to work with. So I was just drawn to these more extreme areas. But then it occurred to me, well, I need to take care of these patients because I actually enjoy it. I mean, I actually like it. Mm. And so I'm the perfect person to do it because they deserve to have a doctor who enjoys working with them and who likes them and who wants to take care of them, instead of a doctor who feels like, oh no, I'm stuck having to see these people that I can't stand. So that's why I decided I just need to go with it. I'll work in yeah. these situations that other doctors don't feel happy with.
So. You have that major case. Certainly, there's no arguing with that. If you like what you're doing, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And especially since you're not making people's lives worse. You're not even making them better. Does this Listen to me now. Now I'm gonna get my cigar out. Now I'm gonna get my open up my box of deluxe Freud cigars and light one. What do you think? Does this have anything to do? You think at a very deep level of your calm of with this whole encephalitis thing? Maybe at a level you don't even understand what?
Maybe. Maybe so.
She says maybe. She didn't even know it. Like that, actually asked the question.
Well, now I'll have to go investigate it.
I just think of when you said that, when you talked about it, I didn't know I had it. And my goodness, encephalitis. I know a guy who got encephalitis while he was playing hockey and the ice broke and he wound up cold or whatever or what have you and lost. He's blind. He wound up being blind, and it was all encephalitis, because he went through, because encephalitis can make you blind, right? Can it?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And, I mean, that could also kill, it could really kill you. I remember they were afraid at one point, my oldest son, when he was younger, and he got this, flu-like things, and they had to give him a spinal, because because he had signs of encephalitis. It was horrible to think that might happen, because that's a deadly thing. It kills people still, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so you didn't know you had it, and then you found, we heard your story last time, which was, I think you should write. There's a book.
Yeah.
Yeah, that stuff, yeah, your personal life there, that stuff. And then, of course, your father committed suicide, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, I remembered that, and you had a great story, great stories. But, I mean, there's stuff everyone could learn things from by reading stuff that actually happened, not stuff that you think that happened, as are documented in my stories. But okay, I just wondering, because you do have a when people say they have a calling, I always ask probably more than they ever want me to ask, because I don't totally understand. I don't have a sense. I don't have in the fiber of my being. I know I don't know what it's like to be called. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Oh, and I think that's true for most people, at least that I talk to. You know, most people have that sense like, wow, I wish I would know. I wish I would have a calling. I wish I would know.
Well, I'm okay. I mean, I'm okay with it, and I'm certainly skeptical about people, who tell me, that God came to them and decided and told them personally that this is their calling. I mean, I that's a little weird for me. But people who have the sense like you do and actually just follow through and do this stuff and then feel good about what you do, that's a true calling. Not some kind of, you don't need the deep voice of Cecil B. DeMille to tell you in a dark room. But right?
Yeah, and for me, even when I was a little kid, I mean, in kindergarten and first grade, when the teacher has you, draw a picture of what you want to be when you grow up, I always drew pictures of being a nurse. Mm-hmm. Always. My pictures were of like a hospital or, me being a nurse. And, when I was 12 years old, my fourth grade teacher said to me, so do you want to be a nurse? Because my fourth grade teacher stayed in touch with me after fourth grade and took me out for lunch one day and said, do you really want to be a nurse? And I said, yes. And she said, you should think about being a doctor. Because girls can be doctors. And she planted the idea in my head. And at 12, I decided she's right. That's what I meant to be, a doctor. And so that was it from then on. I was goal oriented toward that.
That must have been my first problem, because I remember a teacher saying, "What do you want to be?" You do that in a classroom or, yeah. What do you want to be? And my answer was alone. I certainly didn't want to be there, So yeah. I guess I accomplished it. In spades. This is Cthulhu Chronicles. We're still here, and we have at least another 10 minutes with Dr. Karen Wyatt, whose book, What Really Matters, and the new, it's just going to be Other Things That Matters. It's going to be called something like What Really Matters, What Else Really Matters, or what?
I haven't decided yet. I haven't decided, but it seems like I could continue with the What Really Matters theme for a little while, mm-hmm. you know, and so I may try to use What Really Matters in the title some way.
Well, what else really matters is also, or more things that matter, that really matter, that really matter. And of course, I want to, once again, I want everyone, I really encourage all of you people, because I know this, although I do not know personally, and I've not looked in the eyes of many of the people. And there are more and more people who listen to this show and follow us here on Alternative Broadcasting. And I don't know you, but I know that you're screwed up. So you need to look into your, in this thing that I love this thing you have. Get over it. And to really investigate yourself, especially those of you who don't want to go. There's such a stigma, right? There's less of a stigma than there used to be in terms of like seeking help and going to a professional, aside from the financial part of it, right? There's still.
Yeah, definitely. And yeah, what I, this home study course is really something, if you feel like you're a pretty normal person, but you know you just have a few hang-ups, it's something that any of us, we can do this work on our own. We don't necessarily have to pay somebody to help us through it.
And the idea, like you just said, normal, I guess, can be interpreted by any number of people any different number of ways. Anyway.
That's
right?
True.
Okay. So, but you know, if you, I encourage everybody to get this. What's it cost?
It's $129, and it's a 6-week course.
It would cost you, I mean, that's like less than two hours with a decent therapist.
Yeah.
What do they cost now? Some of them might cost $100 an hour.
Right? Yeah, I'm sure some of them do cost $100 an hour.
All right, you people, I want you to get one. Write it down. The website is?
Overitforgood.com.
Over it for good. Okay, for good. And as I remember from therapy, the key is not curing per se, but the key to curing is awareness. Yes. Right?
Yes.
And you got to be aware first. And something like this could make you aware, and it might not be a gigantic thing, even to you, but it might be a gigantic thing to your husband or your boyfriend or your kid, because you know, how many times have we, I remember when I was a kid and I used to, there were just things my mother did. I don't know the way she said something or what she did. And it was like, I would get this feeling like, oh God, are you my mother? How could you do it? You know, it's like you're ashamed or you feel terrible. About, don't do that. What a reflection on me. Uh-oh, I just brought up something. And then Dr. White's sitting there going, yeah, I think you should be taking this, Frank. Like, start tonight, I think. I have, I'm just telling everyone out there, because I'm constantly, and I don't, and then this is really bad, Dr. White, and that is, I walk around during the day, and I'm like five different therapists. I guess, does this sound like, am I schizophrenic? I'm like five different therapists walk with me every day. And when I do something, you know, they're like, it's important to me to say things like, you see what you just did? That's your mother. You know?
So you're self-analyzing your behavior. Yeah.
And the idea that I'm aware of it, I found that the idea that I become aware of these things really allows me to feel okay in social conditions and out in, you know, when I'm dealing with the world as opposed to myself. It doesn't matter when I deal with myself. That doesn't matter, right? But when I have to deal with other people in business or in, because relationships are relationships. They're all, you do it whether you're intimate or not intimate, right, with someone. And
And awareness is the first step toward getting control over it. You may not get rid of that behavior within yourself, but if you're aware of it and you know what triggers it, you don't necessarily have to act on it.
Right.
You know, those thoughts and feelings can be there, but you don't necessarily have to act it out anymore.
And that is like, in essence, that is such a simple concept. And yet, no, wow, do people not get that?
Yeah.
And I guess there's only a billion reasons why they wouldn't, but So what do you think is going, what do you, I don't ask you to predict, but let's talk about Death with Dignity. Do you think this is going to become maybe as popular as, popular is a bad word, I guess, but I mean, do you think this will move into an area like where a same-sex marriage is right now? Because, I mean, well, it wasn't long ago. There was one or two states and then bingo, right? Do you think this can have that kind of a sweep?
I think it could. I think it may take a few years and a few more cases will need to come up. But I think everyone's watching Brittany Maynard right now to see what happens. You know, how does this end up? And so I just think we're on the verge of a big change on the whole, and just our whole society looking at death and dying and the end of life and talking about it and being open and planning for it, and I think that's all happening all at once.
So we should hear from once we hear from Pope Francis about this. I mean, this is one of those things. He might have to say something about this. Me, I'm just happy that there's a Pope Frank. I never thought there would be one, but what? Because look at all the stuff that's going on there socially with the and in their attempts to try to keep people inside of the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing to me. Never in my life would I have imagined we could see the changes that we're seeing there. So it's fascinating. Like things are happening.
Sure. I mean, there's an institution. There's an institution that sent people. I know I'm going back a few years here, friends, but you know history, right? There's an institution that sent people to war to kill people if they didn't believe the way they believed. And now, right? And forget about even that. Let's not even look at the Crusades. Let's go to, like, what? Let's go to, like, Pope John, you know, the fat guy when I was growing up. The fat one, the one when Kennedy was president.
Yeah.
Even back then, what was kept in the closet, what was kept... right? Because they still had so much power over moral imperative and laws and things. Think of the changes since then. Yikes.
Yeah, it's interesting. It just tells you big things are happening here. A lot of shifts are happening and a lot of opening up in how we look at things and how we do things. So I definitely think in the Death with Dignity arena that change is coming. I don't know how long it will take, but I think the Brittany Maynard case, it's very pivotal at creating all this controversy and getting everyone talking about it and aware of it. It's huge, you know, so her courage to stand up and let her story be talked about by so many people and examined and critiqued. I mean, it's amazing that she's able and willing to do that.
Yeah, take some guts. And we're going to follow what happens and listen to the feedback and the stuff that goes on. And then I hope that for that reason and all the other regular reasons, I can call upon you again to be here.
Yeah, definitely. And at the Death Expo that I'm doing in November, I think there each night we're having this virtual Death Cafe every night, where people can call in and we have conversations together in the evenings. And I'm pretty sure that will be one of our topics that we'll be discussing, I'm sure.
Great. I'll blog that and I'll make sure everybody knows about it. I'll put it on the agenda here so that we could promote it as much as we can. And I may even go. You may actually see me there.
Oh, that would be awesome.
Really? You really? Because you don't, you know, you could tell me if you don't want me. I won't be here. You won't hurt my feelings.
No, I would love that. I really want to see a lot of people show up for this and participate, because that's the whole idea, is just for people to get educated about death and dying, mm-hmm. and be out in the open and able to talk about it and talk about different issues.
Well, then I will be there somewhere between November 13th and 16th. I'll go there. I'll register and I'll get some other people to do it. And I hope that I won't mess up the joint by when I show
up. All
right.
Well, I don't think you can.
Okay. Well, thank you again. I so appreciate the fact that you were available again and you took your time out to do this, because, you know, real radio is dead. Speaking to death, this is where it's happening in alternative broadcasting. And I'm so happy that we met along the way, because I get so many emails from nudniks and crazy people that write books every day that want to be on the show, and I just don't want to. There's no way I could spend an hour and a half talking to them. But you're you know, you're a blessing to anybody who wants a guest, and I would certainly appreciate it, Dr. Wyatt. And you know, we'll thank you.
You did a lot for me just telling me I don't fall in that nudnik category. Thanks for reassuring me.
Well, you see, thank you. But now I feel like I have a calling. I've met my calling. Okay, doctor, we'll talk to you again. We'll be in touch. I'll see you at Death Expo.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Frank.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Wow, she's cool, isn't she? She is so cool. Okay, thank you. Thanks for your feedback, says Skype. That was excellent. It was excellent. That was very, very in tune and exactly sonic. DeathExpo.com. I'll start promoting it right now as we come to the end of this particular show here. My name is Frank Cotolo. I'm the man whose name adorns the title of this show. You've been listening to Cotolo Chronicles. I've been chronicling. And this was a real, like the other ones were fake. This was such a chronicle, considering this is like in the news. I'm going to be on eventually. I don't know if you, it might be too late for those of you who listen to this on the replay, but I know I'm going to be on Joel McCallick's show. I don't know if it's this Sunday, next Sunday, what have you, on the mic. I forgot the name of the show, and I don't know. We'll be, go to CotoloChronicles.blogspot.com to find out exactly what happens, where, or when. Or, better than that, because that usually just goes once a week for this show, at Frank Cotolo. Go follow me, because there's tons of stuff that goes on that is good for you to know, and funny stuff. Go to at Daily Meds, M-E-D-Z, at Daily Meds, M-E-D-Z, Daily Meds, one word. It's Twitter. Follow. It's wacky wisdom. It's good wisdom. It's stuff. Yeah, you never know how people are going to take this stuff. But it's a lot of fun. And it costs you nothing to get it. And then, on Facebook, of course I'm there. I was one of the first 10,000 people on Facebook. I say that like I wear a badge. Like it's something, well, you know, I was there. I'm on the cutting edge. This is the cutting edge. And we're going to have Dr. Waldar, Tom Savino, and who knows what else going on when we talk about going through the rabbit hole and various other stuff that goes on next week on this show at SRN Media Works and all the other stations carrying this show. I'm not going to drop names because there's too many of them. Go to CotoloChronicles.blogspot.com to find out those particular stations. What else? Buy License a Skill at Amazon. It's a digital book. And we'll be telling you more about more Molotov memoirs. T. Stephen Gestick is designing it even as we speak. What else? What else can I tell you? It's time to put the saddle on the horse. And you know these other great little things, these stupid cliches. I don't even have one. I have to make it up, right? Well, it's time to put the squirrel in your backpack. And there goes that voice again. Time to put the chemicals inside your milk and throw it over your left shoulder because the show is over for tonight in the Y2K plus 14. Yeah, that's where we are. I think it's time for the theme, don't you? Here we go. We'll remind you again about DeathExpo.com next week here on the show and various other things having to do with Dr. Karen Wyatt. Great products because they're not, because they're good for you. They're not. Why go to the negative? To the positive. They are good for you. They're good things. My name is Frank Cotolo. I'm in his name and don't the title of the show. You know where to get me. You know how to get in touch with me. You know where I am at any given point. I just want to say to you that we should both tell Mrs. Ernstweil, good night. Good night, Mrs. Ernstweil. But it's me, Frank Tolo. Me, Frank Atolo. Time to go. Thank you, Dr. Karen Wyatt, once again. A wonderful guest, a great doctor, and I wish he was nearby because I got this pain in my left arm, whatever the case. Let's get me out of here! Because I have nothing more to say.